is here. It's called meeting order. Pledge allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You're on, Kate.
All right. I'll do the roll call. Dean Giovanni.
Here.
Michael Borstein.
Yes, ma'am.
Doug Kelly.
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Here.
And Eli Beck.
Here.
And noting Danny Homer absent.
Yeah. Okay. Item 3 is open period for public participation. It's time for public to address anything that is not on our agenda tonight. Seeing no one in the audience, anyone else speaking from the public? Seeing none, we'll move on to item 4, consent calendar. These are matters listed under these items are considered routine and will be enacted by one motion. Can I have a motion to accept or approve items 4A through I?
I so move.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No one opposed. Okay. Item 5, CMSA secretary appointment.
Okay.
Hi, Dan.
Hello,
Dan.
Not a problem. With the appointment of Commissioner DiGiovanni last month as our board chair, we have a vacancy in the secretary position. I discussed that vacancy with the chair prior to the agenda going out, and we agreed that we should put on the agenda, and the board could consider nominating and appointing a commissioner as the board's secretary for the remaining portion of this fiscal year. That'll be to the July meeting.
And I'd like to just add to that is I brought it up to the general manager that I was secretary still, and that I thought we should bring it out to the board for open discussion in case anyone else wanted to take it on. I'm happy to continue on doing it. It's not a huge administrative burden, but I didn't want to be perceived, or I just want to throw it out on the table in case anyone else wanted to step up and participate.
I think you then have to, because sometimes the chair and the secretary
have to sign. Have signed off.
I don't think you can sign both.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I make a motion?
That's your name.
I'd move to ask or invite or nominate Eli as our board secretary.
Second.
Third.
Fourth.
All in favor.
I accept.
Okay.
Oh,
no.
That's
not how this works.
That's your handwriting.
It's good.
Excellent. In all seriousness, do you accept the nomination?
Yes.
Okay, great. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none? Aye. Congratulations.
Thank you. What an honor.
You told him about the content set up in the other room?
I told him there was not much to do, but I was just kind of fudging that a little bit.
Bring it on.
we'll ease him into it.
Okay, item 6, the proposed debt issuance plan.
Okay, thank you. So, in the agency's 5-year revenue plan that was adopted by the board, there's 2 planned debt issuances to assist with funding the agency's 10-year capital program. Those are originally scheduled in fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 24. So we have revenues built into the 5-year revenue plan for a debt issuance in fiscal year 20. And in the plan, that's about $9 million of 20-year term and about 3.5% interest rate on the tax-exempt revenue bonds. Then in discussions with our financial advisor, Sarah Hollenbeck with PFM, in September, Ken and I learned that PFM is tracking on these projections for tax-exempt municipal bond interest rate increases over time, mm-hmm. especially in calendar year 2019. Mm-hmm. So she advised that if you're really looking at issuing debt, that you may want to consider doing it sooner than later so you won't have the higher interest, you know, in the future. So we brought that to the board in October. We discussed it. There was a PowerPoint presentation that we kind of referred to, provided by PFM for the staff reports. And the board directed staff and the finance committee to prepare a debt issuance plan and bring that back to the board at a future meeting. And at that time, we said we'd target bring it back in January. So that's why we're here tonight. So we did. The finance committee met a couple times over the fall in October, November, and they prepared a plan. And the plan is shown on page one, and really it's page one on the top of page two of the staff reports. And there's actions for the board tonight, if you want to take some action. That could be on each individual element of the plan that's listed, or it could be on the entire plan, or we could break it up into two components for two different actions. And I kind of, for discussion purposes, I'd recommend maybe the two component approach. So the first would be the issuance type, and that would be tax-exempt revenue bonds, like we did back in 2006 and refinanced in 2015. Along with that would be the financing teams. That would be PFM as a financial advisor, who we have a good relationship with, and Hawkins Delfield Wood as the Bond Disclosure Council. And their fees for those services are $51,500 for PFM and $67,500 for the Bond Council, and that has a contingency for expenses in it. And they're agreeable with those fees being good for a couple years, so they wouldn't change if we decided to postpone. And then we looked at a couple methods of selling the bonds, either a negotiated bid or competitive bid, and looked at the pros and cons of each, and the committee is recommending that we use a competitive bid to sell to different underwriters. So that's kind of like the first package, is the team, the costs, the sale method, and the type of issuance. Then the second is, you know, the timing of the issuance. And originally we planned for fiscal year 20, and the reason for that was we assumed that we would implement and deliver all the capital projects last year, and that next year we would have a shortage in capital reserves to fund all of that CIP and future CIP while maintaining the board's, you know, kind of policy for a minimum level of CIP reserves. So based on that, we had the issuance scheduled for 20. A couple things have happened since then. One is that with the closing of the books for fiscal year 18 and the completing of the audit financial statements, we have excess monies from fiscal year 18 that can be used for capital funding for fiscal year 20 and beyond. Those are driven by three factors. One is on the operating expense side, it was less than the operating budget. So we received more revenues than we intended. The expenses were a little less. So there's about, you know, $300,000 to $400,000 on the operating side. That's money that was new for us. And then we had about $130,000 additional dollars beyond what was in the budget for capacity charges. And then we, of course, didn't complete all the capital projects that we thought we'd complete or initiate last fiscal year. So there's about $1.5 million there. So in total, it was a little over $1.8 million additional that we have for capital funding. So the need to issue the debt in fiscal year 20 for funding purposes isn't as dire as we thought when we prepared the revenue plan. So from a funding perspective, we could wait a year. That's okay with staff and the committee, and we can make everything happen. And additionally, this year, we're probably not going to spend all $2.8 million that we have in the capital program. We might achieve 50 to 70% of that. So we'll have additional monies left in unrestricted and restricted reserves for future capital funding. Then there's the projected interest rate increase. So we did prepared a sensitivity analysis on a $9 million debt, 20-year term, 3.5% interest rate. And if we postponed the issuance for one fiscal year, approximately, we'd save about $320,000, assuming those terms of the debt. However, if the interest rate increased about 0.3% in that time period, that'll consume all that savings, and then we'll have, over the term of the bonds, we'll have higher interest, you know, total payments. So that's the risk for the board to consider. So what the committee thought was, well, we should recommend postponing, but then have staff with the financial advisor kind of track on the interest rates, and if they look like they're going to increase to where the overall assumed, you know, payments and interest are going to be greater than what's in the revenue plan in our planning documents, that we'd come back to the board with a recommendation to issue the debt sooner than a year from fiscal year 20. So that's kind of the two pieces of it. It's all the technical pieces for the team and the types of bonds and the type of sale, and then the timing of it.
Question. You're the chair. Can you wait? say you decide you need to do this, can you wait the whole period of time to a board meeting? Or do you need, would it be better if you had the authority to make that decision?
You'd have to start the process. You could start the process, but you couldn't actually initiate a bond sale.
Yeah, the process itself, once we gave the team the authorization to proceed, it might be as long as, you know, 4 months before everything is completed and we have the official statement and it's all advertised and we have the electronic bid opening.
I see.
So if it looked as if the rates were going to rise to a point where we're going to have more expenses in the future and we want to issue sooner, it's likely we can have a board meeting right after that information, unless it's like a full 30 days and it's looking really bad and, you know, then the board could delegate authority for certain situations. Or we call a special meeting also, which within 24 hours.
My point is create the optimal timing that you would need for the worst possible.
Yeah, no, that's important. I appreciate that. Yeah.
I agree. That, what I think we should do is issue you the authority to begin the process. But I think before you issue any bonds, the board should be responsible for that. So if it doesn't come at a regular meeting, it can't come because then I think you should call an emergency. You should ask the chair, whoever the chair might be, to call an emergency meeting so that the board can be responsible for our own debt issuances. But I fully agree with Dan that we prep you up so that you can get all your ducks in a row and pull the trigger when you need to pull the trigger.
Well, that is the whole idea behind part one of that, is that we get the bond council and, you know, everybody's in place and they have all of them agreed to maintain their fee right now for the next few years so that everything is in place for that. And, you know, if they were to come to us and say, you know, our projection is that 3 months out, it's going to go up a little bit. I'm probably not going to go up 3% at a 0.3 at a time.
That's right. But
I just want to
make
sure
we're not in place. Denying you something that would give you optimal flexibility.
I appreciate that. I do. Yeah, I think what we'll do is we could, if the board's agreeable with the team and the process, and then you're agreeable with the issuance in 21, unless the rates increase, we'll let the team know that tomorrow. And we'll ask them to track the interest rates, and if they start creeping up, it looks like we're going to, you know, lose money over time. Let us know, and then we'll I'll let the chair know. We can decide if we can wait until the next meeting or call a special meeting.
You can also call a special meeting or just the finance committee to bring this a smaller group together to make a recommendation back to the board.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. That's a good idea. We should probably do that first.
Yes.
Bring the committee together. Yeah, let's do that.
And, I mean, right now, I mean, from when we started this process, when we got the information back in September, interest rates were going up, and now they've sort of inverted back on the long-term rates, so they're actually going back down on long-term. So, you know, things were tracking up, and then whatever is happening with the economy, I don't understand why, but the last I heard, they're sort of tracking back down now again, so... And then, you might correct me, but don't we, as an agency, have to have like specific need before we issue debt? So, like, we could issue it today, knowing we got this capital plan out there, but we really don't need the money now. Is there a timing issue that we have to sort of stick within?
My understanding of that is once we issue the debt and receive the proceeds, that's advisable that. You use a proceeds within like 3 to 5 years.
Okay,
that's what I've heard.
Okay,
so we have plenty of projects in the capital plan to support a $9 billion issuance. What would happen is we just keep the reserve a little higher if we didn't, you know, spend all the project funds this year and next year.
Hire a bunch of consultants.
They can spend the money for us. That's right. Sure. Real fast.
Well, it seems to me that it's prudent to put off issuing the debt as long as we reasonably can. So if we can lock in these fees, which are great, fixed fees, and then just wait patiently until need catches up with interest rates.
That's pretty much what the finance committee came up with here, and deferring things out for one fiscal year out to 21 versus 20.
So is my idea okay with you guys voting on, you know, the type of issuance and the team and the type of sale, so we can kind of get that kind of decision made, and I can let them know that, and then we'll have a second action on delaying the issuance while tracking on the interest rates and based on, you know, what the need is in the interest rate environment, calling the committee together to make a recommendation on the board if needed.
So can I suggest this? And are we sure we're saying the amount you're looking at is $9 million, right?
That's what's in the revenue plan. That, you know,
that
may change as we convene the committee together and talk about it.
Would it be appropriate, Mr. Chair, to have a motion to prepare an issuance type that's tax-exempt revenue bonds with a financial advisor of PFM and a bond counsel of Hawkins, Deffield, Wood, and a competitive bid method for $9 million, and to prepare that, but not to execute that until such time as the general manager brings that to the attention of the financial committee and the full board?
So that would be locking in the timing, not locking in the timing, but including timing as part of it to be determined at a later date.
Yes, correct.
So we're just doing one motion or one action that includes the timing, but the timing will be to come back to the board after the finance committee meets to say we're ready to go.
Makes sense.
Don't we need to be just a little bit more specific that we're postponing because we adopted a schedule and now we want to change that schedule?
Okay.
So sort of our tentative plan is that it would occur in
21.
In fiscal year 21, that's what we're adopting now as our tentative timing plan, and we're accepting these two vendors, and planning on a competitive bid for the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that.
Yeah.
Do we add the caveat though to the action that should it be advantageous for the agency due to interest rates to move that debt issuance forward
based on the committee recommendation?
Based on the finance committee recommendation, that will be brought back to a future meeting, but as we move forward now, it's going out in 21.
By actual debt issuance be considered at the recommendation at the finance committee at whatever time that occurs?
Yeah, so, okay. That's fine with me.
Can somebody summarize that?
Second.
Okay, we got
So I guess all those items and the timing issue being we're going in 21, and I think what I heard Michael saying is then we come back no matter what by the finance committee to tell the board when we're actually going to go. If it could be if it's sooner due to interest rates spiking up where we need to act sooner, or if we're just going to go as planned, we just come back and say, yeah,
we're going to have to give reasons, just say.
Mm-hmm. Right, this is our plan now, and the finance committee recommends otherwise.
Finance committee will come back before the issuance.
Sure, yeah, that's good.
Okay. I make that motion. Oh, I'm sorry, I second that motion because Dan made it.
I thought you made the motion.
No, you're seconding it. Okay,
we're thirding. Okay.
Yeah. You made the motion. I clarified the timing issue. You said right on.
Okay,
and,
there you go.
Poor Kate.
So we have a motion from Commissioner Kelly. We have a second by Commissioner Hilmer. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay.
All right.
I think it's pretty much as described.
Yeah,
it is. Okay, item 7, the 2019 compensation market survey for the agency's job classification. And this is an authorization for the general manager to conduct a compensation market study, market survey.
Thank you. Yes, so the last compensation survey that was performed was in kind of mid-2013 in preparation for our negotiations with the union for the represented group and with the unrepresented group. And those were all successful, and we have a MOU now to 2022. And in that MOU, there's a provision that says CMSA will perform another market survey in and around March 2019, the same format as the 2009 survey. The 2013 survey was the same format as 2009, which was the same as 2006, and 2003 has involved in all those surveys. So we have engaged Coffin Associates, our HR consultant, who's done a lot of work for us on the classification administration side, on comp surveys and recruitments, and they provide a proposal for $11,500 not to exceed. And that proposal will evaluate 19 classifications at the agency, compare those to close classifications at 12 to 13 of our comparator organizations, and they will prepare a report, and that report will have kind of an analysis for each of those 19 classifications. We'll look at what's the total monthly salary, what's the total benefit cost for the month, and what's the total monthly compensation. It'll have our agency compared to the others, and it'll have then the median and the average, and it'll compare us to those two metrics. And so the process is that if the board did authorize this, then we would offer to meet and confer with the union to discuss the process and the format. And we do the same thing with the unrepresented employees. COF conduct a survey. The first draft will be shared with both groups. They could ask questions. They could have suggested changes. We'd evaluate those, give some direction to COF. Then we have a second draft. We bring that to the board in closed session for you to review and make any decisions or proposals or not. The agency's obligation is to conduct the survey and to meet and confer on the results. That's it. So it's $11,500, and if this is approved, I will inform COF tomorrow, and I'll inform both employee groups.
Discussion?
Question? Why are we seeing this? It's such a small amount of money. Isn't this within your... What's your signature authority? It's
$60,000.
Yeah.
Well, this is just because we have some new board members that aren't familiar with this process, so I thought it'd be appropriate to bring it to the board to just explain the past processes. It's a little more detailed than me just, say, having it as an oral report.
Sentences. So it's just not a signal that every $10,000 contract is going to be coming.
Oh, no. It was just trying to be helpful.
Okay. You know,
that's pretty much it.
To avoid further embarrassment, I want to make the motion to adopt the staff recommendation.
Second.
Yes, and I would also like to just say that in the future, as the, I believe, the newest board member, if you want to just bring this type of item up with me at our pre-meeting meeting, that is fine as well.
Okay, great. So,
thank you.
Sure.
So we have a motion and a second to authorize the GM to conduct a compensation market survey for the agency's represented and unrepresented job classifications.
Call for public comment.
Yeah, I was going to say. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay, passes.
Great, thank you.
Item 8 is to display the 2018 California Water and Environment Association Awards, Redwood Empire section.
Okay, thank you. So CMSA is a member of the Redwood Empire section of the California Water Environment Association, and each year they have award categories and award committees, and we apply for awards each year around the end of the summertime. So this year we received 8 awards. Wow. And those are on the staff reports. So you have individual awards. So the groupings, they have individual awards for classifications, and they have awards for programs, rewards for projects, special activities, and for this organization. So we have several individual award winners. Electrical instrumentation goes to John Farr, mechanical technician to Jacob Dillinger, essentially public outreach to Mary Jo Ramey, operator of the year to Ryan Ward, outstanding young professional to Amy Wang. I think most of you know Amy. She came and gave a presentation on the maintenance building, the expansion project. And then the P3S, that's a stormwater pollution prevention and pre-treatment program person of the year. So that's great news for those employees. And then for our countywide public education program with the other 5 wastewater agencies that have treatment plants, we won the Redwood Empire Section Award. And then organizationally, we were recognized with the Engineering Achievement Award for the Power Delivery Program. So that's all great news. So we normally bring this to the board in December if we receive awards from CWEA. They're kind of late on doing the review of the application, so that's why it's before the board in January. And we also have a resolution that's prepared by the managers of all of the employees, individual award winners, and people that are in charge of the programs and maybe the engineering project. So they've contributed to the various little write-ups in the whereas sections. So the staff recommendation is for the board to pass the resolution.
I would move that. Very happy.
Second.
And keep bringing these things.
Yeah,
oh, yeah. Love yeah. these.
It's really nice. Please pass on from the board our congratulations to all the individuals.
Sure,
those,
sure.
Both, if you could do that personally to each of them, and that we truly recognize their solid work effort and diligence in their jobs, and also just working as a team to accomplish the regional awards and the organizational award.
I will definitely do that. Thank you.
So may I have a, we have to vote on this? Okay.
Yeah, there's that
motion.
We did.
And second?
I move to second.
Okay.
He's second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? He was in and a second hand.
Okay.
I'm old.
That's
fast.
Hey, we have item 9, the CoGen pre-design evaluation project technology assessment. This is an informational item.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So Corello Engineers is making good progress on the cogeneration system pre-design evaluation report. They've completed two of the project's tasks. One is the CEQA evaluation for a project, and the second is completing the technology assessment. So in the technology assessment, which is really the focus of the staff report, they evaluated three different types of cogeneration system technologies and a couple different biogas treatment technologies. And on the cogeneration side, that was internal combustion engine, which we have now, a 750-kilowatt unit. Waukesha manufactures it. Also microturbines, and those come in different sizes, and a fuel cell. And the smallest one is 1.4 megawatts. So they evaluated those, and this is a high-level evaluation. And the fuel cell didn't meet some of the screening criteria. Primarily, it won't fit within the open bay within the solids handling building, which means it would have to be placed somewhere else, so more construction costs for excavation and foundations and piles and interconnections, things like that. And it has the highest present worth cost also, and capital, well, total project costs. So we screened that one out initially at the beginning of the assessment. So then it became more of a close look between the internal combustion engine and the microturbines, and the engine also comes in three different sizes. And microturbines, it's likely that all of the microturbines wouldn't fit in the bay, so some may need to be located somewhere else, or we have to get really creative how we fit them in that room, which could impact, you know, accessibility for maintenance staff. So that was a consideration. Also, the microturbines, the smallest unit is about the same project cost as the smallest cogen unit, but higher O&M cost. So the present worth of it is higher than the cogen. But most importantly, the microturbines are less energy efficient than the cogen engine-based systems, so they're going to produce less power with the same amount of biogas. So that was pretty significant. So ultimately, those were screened out. So the preferred alternative is a IC-based engine cogeneration system, and Coral is using that to move forward into the pre-design with. And the pre-design report should be completed in the March to April timeframe. So the engine, there's three different sizes that are close to our existing size. As I know the staff report, there's 850, 1065, and 1100 kilowatts. For the 850, that's part of the pre-design. If we went forward with that, as soon as that was installed, because of the 33% more efficiency, we would be energy self-sufficient as soon as we started it up, and we'd start to be delivering power to Marine Clean Energy. You know, excess power. And we'd still have a little bit of capacity left in the engine to receive more organics and use more biogas from the organic digestion for power export. Then there's, you know, the two larger engines. So tonight, before the board, really is it's informational item. It's just to present the findings from the assessment and to let you know that there are three different size engines. And we'll be considering, you know, the sizes in the future, because there's some questions about the are there organics that are available that we could bring to the agency to produce more biogas and utilize that extra capacity. We think there are, but we need to do some outreach and identify the different sources and suppliers. There's, you know, a big study we have to complete, which is a pilot study looking at, you know, how much of this organic material can we feed into the digesters relative to wastewater solids. There may be kind of a threshold value, and, you know, is there one, and what is that, and how does that translate to engine capacity? If there's none, that's great, then the 1100 would probably be the recommended, you know, system. But after, you know, several months, once we have the system in place and we have several months of testing data, if it says, well, it's going to be at, say, this 50% feed level relative to wastewater solids, then we may be limited to not utilizing more than the 850 engine. So there's some pilot testing on site that we have to do, extended length pilot testing. So we're not recommending a size right now to the board, because we have to answer some of these questions. There's also questions regarding the new interconnection with PG&E for a bigger capacity engine. Is there any issues with their system and working through that process? And it takes a long time to work with PG&E through the interconnection process. We're still trying to get our current agreements in place. And then with MC, there's some language in their power purchase agreement with nameplate limitations, and we have to talk to them about that. What does that mean? We've heard from them that a couple things. One thing was, we said, well, if we put this 850 in, it has a larger nameplate than what's stated in the agreement. And they said, well, really the agreement, what we really care about is how much we've committed to buying power. So remember, in that agreement, we said the most we would have extra is 150 kilowatts, which translated to 1.3 million kilowatt hours for the year. So they said, we're going to pay you the 10.5 cents for that. If you put in a different size engine, anything you produce above that, you'll have a separate agreement for. They'll probably be paying less. So we're kind of worried about how that would work out. So we keep the current agreement in place with the higher rate, then we have likely a lower rate with any excess power. But then there's the nameplate question that we have to work out with them, because there's limitations of 1,000 kilowatts in the contract.
Yeah, are you guys beyond or over that?
Either one of the larger engines is over that. Yeah. But, you know, they have that, when they have those nameplates, it's really kind of for a system that's generating up to that amount of power and delivering it to them. We have a demand here, so even if we had a 1.1, which exceeds that nameplate,
the excess won't get there.
We're only going to have, you know, 600 excess maybe, not even that, maybe 500 excess. So the excess will be less than the nameplate.
That's
so we have to have that conversation with them and see what.
That's lucky.
Yeah. As you know from our last discussions with them on the PPA, they tend not to be too flexible.
Well, with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
we were very good in clarifying that we can go from zero all the way up to that nameplate.
Yeah, yeah, we got that specific language in one of those appendices, which was beneficial to us. That was good. That was our best idea.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my idea on this though is maybe a little bit unexpected, but this the type of power that we're capable of generating here is so valuable in the broader sense, not just dollars. This is exceptionally environmentally sound electricity that we're generating here. And we need to maximize our generation potential. And I know that on a planning basis, you know, we have to forecast how much we're going to be able to get in the digesters and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can't lock that in and be certain, but I would rather err on the side of having excess generation capability and be out there looking for ways to build the digesters then have a surplus gas available and not able to burn it.
I agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Thank you.
The largest engine has the lowest present worth value. I mean, lowest present worth cost, too.
Yeah, I'd have to look at it. Does?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, that's good for you, yeah. That's one of the tables.
Table 1.5
has volume discount?
Yeah, it's just, and that's allowing us to go and be able to generate more power.
Yeah. really the key for us, we believe we can work everything out with AG&E. That may take some time. With MCE, that can take some time. The incremental cost from going from 850 to 1100 might be a few hundred thousand dollars in additional cost just for the units. But the installation costs will be kind of very, very similar. So the project cost won't be that much more. But it's really figuring out how much of the material can we feed in the digester without having an upset of the digester.
Right.
That's the main thing we have to figure out. So next month, I'll be sharing with the board, more of an informational item, is that we're looking at buying a kind of like a digester pilot testing, you know, trailer-mounted system from a utility in Pennsylvania. And it's about $15,000, and they'll sell it to us. And it has two big tanks on it, so one would be a control tank, one would be the test tank, like 300 gallons. Then we would outfit it with, you know, piping, with flow meters, with gas receiving equipment, with instrumentation. Then we'd run that, we'd get it all stabilized, and we'd run it according to a kind of a biosolids pilot testing plan. And we have a technical advisory committee where consultants that have expertise in anaerobic digestion and food waste processing have agreed on their own time to serve on this committee to help us formulate the plan and give us technical advice while we're evaluating the different, you know, different testing scenarios. Because this hasn't been done in anywhere really in the United States where you're doing the kind of testing on these multiple, you know, sources of organics. There's a lot of testing done on the fat oils in Greece, where there's these limitations. But right now, sometimes of the week or the season, we're higher than those limitations, and our digesters are just fine. So we're thinking the food waste kind of changes the chemistry mm-hmm. of the fog, so that way the microbes and the digesters can have a higher level of what they call volatile solids loading, organic loading relative to the wastewater solids. So our new technical service manager, he has a lot of contacts in the industry, and he's formed a technical review panel. And they're helping prepare the test plan. So next month, I was going to share with you a summary of the test plan and show you this kind of funky-looking thing we're buying and what it's going to look. I'll describe what it looks like when it's done and kind of give you a summary of all the costs. It'll be expensive. It's within our authority. But I just want to share it with you because it's a big part of the power delivery program. And more importantly, the whole testing protocol to help us answer what's the limitation on the feeding of the digester so we can select one of these size units here.
It sounds like sort of a rolling science fair project.
It is. It's a real big one.
But absolutely, and I hope there's a plan to write a report or a paper that we published so that we can share this learning with the rest of the country.
I think each of those consulting firms that have people on the panel, they'll work with us to write papers and give presentations at various industry association events. Yeah, I'm pretty confident of that.
I see an award in this.
Maybe
for somebody.
Yeah.
I see a road trip.
$50 a copy.
I see a road trip. U-Haul.
Is it Don Gap?
Going through Iowa.
Don Gap. East Bay
Memorial. Bring in the guys to
tell us. Yeah, who's studying with
the band? When
they were implementing all those
things. No, I think there's a kind of an organic waste expert with Black and Beach that's on the panel. Crollo Engineers has a digestion specialist on the panel. Veolia has some on the panel. I think it's pretty much all consultants or service providers, not really any staff from public agencies. Then one thing I didn't mention, because I got excited talking about the engines and systems, is the biogas treatment alternatives. There's a few different alternatives, and just based on the success of the system we have, we think, and it has extra capacity, that'll work with, you know, the A50 size engine, but we're going to make some modifications to it to create some redundancy, and it can be expanded into the future if we go with a larger size engine.
Mm-hmm. And just one last question. You could always burn natural gas, right?
Yeah, the engines will be designed to use natural gas or biogas as a fuel.
Right, so if you built the big one and it didn't have enough biogas, you could use natural gas to generate electricity was the objective.
Yeah, that'd get kind of tricky because right now our PPA is for delivering renewable power.
Oh.
And if we that's biogas, it's natural gas, that's brown power, so we'd have to have a different kind of a power purchase agreement for that. Okay. But, you know, these engines, like our current engine, it runs exclusively on one gas or the other. and it switches between gases, so we know exactly the runtime for each gas. But if we had a bigger engine, you could blend the gases and monitor how much you blend, and then maybe sell the percentage of the dark green stuff out. But that's, we have to explore that.
But there'd be a way to maximize the utility of the installed capacity.
Yeah.
You might get there faster than you think. Because you got your PG&E caps, the amount you can put on the grid at a megawatt.
Right, but we don't know what the future is going to bring. And
no, so you've got some excess in there.
Yeah, this is the one generated electric generating resource in Marin County. Is that right?
Yeah, I think in the county, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. I predict you'll be maxing it out soon enough.
Yeah,
are you suggesting we run it optimal from day one?
Yeah. Well, always be optimal, yeah. Whatever's optimal.
So at a megawatt.
Yeah, we need, if we had a bigger engine, we'd need approval to deliver up to a megawatt. But we'd never deliver that much, right? Because we're limited to the engine minus our demand.
Right. Is she suggesting use the...
Well, I'm thinking in emergency situations. For an emergency situation, it's nice to have a source of electric generation in the county.
Yeah. If we needed to, like there was a disaster and there was long-term power outage, we could max out. Say we had a 1.1 and a 750. We say, okay, we're going to run all the biogas in the 750. We're going to run the 1.1 with natural gas, and we're going to send all of this out to the grid for the local
keep the lights
community.
On
yeah.
And if all the power plants go down, we'll still be.
And you'll all have power.
I'm going to park in the parking lot.
Okay, what are we doing now? Are we doing
the business? Just informational items.
This is just informational to get any thoughts you had, like we shared on the site of the engine.
Okay, we're informed.
Okay. I read the whole report. It's a very good report and very thorough.
It's really cool.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading it.
I thought fuel cell would be really cool, but no, it doesn't make sense.
Well, the interesting part is, well, one, it's not going to fit, and then even though, I guess I have one comment, is that we are going for power generation and not emissions, because the IC engines are... We do have to get an air permit there.
Yeah, that's right. We'll need to get a permit to construct, then permit to operate. Yeah. And that's part of the the code design. There's a task in the pre-design report to talk with the Air Board about that and make sure that the emission systems on the engine, at least the pre-design, will meet the current and even like the South Coast Air Management District's emissions for IC engines operating on biogas and natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
It's really strict down that air basin, so we'd make sure that our system, whatever form it took, could comply with their requirements in the south.
Mm-hmm. And, and these manufacturers they've done engines for the South Coast District.
I don't know if they have. I know that Jenbacher they installed 1.1 megawatt engine over at Union Sanitary District in Fremont, which would be very similar to the big size engine that we have here. And it's not necessarily the engine, it's more the emissions control systems that you need to have on the engine to meet the emissions requirements.
If this gets to a point, electricity is going to be going up, not down in cost, in my view. If we get to the point where we're fully maximizing the ICE units, the two units, one proposed and one that we have, couldn't we add a fuel cell if we wanted to at some point? Can we add, or are they incompatible to work with each other?
Well, yeah, we could, it'd be like a modular, setup where you could add additional, biogas utilizing pieces of equipment. We have to make sure that we have enough organics coming in, we have the capacity to digest.
My point is, if it gets to there, that's can come back on the table, and we can add a fuel cell at some point. We have to put it somewhere. We have to build it, but if that all makes sense, and if we have the fuel, then we can always address that. This is the right answer for now.
Okay.
I agree, because what would it take? 1/100th the pollutant of an ICE. Not that the ICE is going to be that huge, but it's certainly a great idea, and it converts well. You just need a lot more fuel to burn.
Yeah, well, well, they emit just more pollutant, whereas the fuel cell.
No, that's what I'm saying. The fuel cell does 1/100th of the pollutants.
Yes.
And the microturbine too.
And the microturbine is less.
You know, it's a CO2 being emitted.
Right. But it all makes sense. The engine fits. It's the lowest cost and the most efficient.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
How big is this IC unit? I mean, the fuel cell unit?
Like in dimensions?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the dimensions of it.
Okay.
I don't even think that's included in the report. They just, the consultant knows the dimensions, and they know the dimensions of the room, and they just said, it won't fit. We believe you, okay.
Yeah. A lot of components there.
If you want, I could find out.
No. I the report was exceptionally thorough. I trust that they can do measurements. That was one of their first conclusions. If they got that wrong, we're really talking to the wrong people. Just start this whole thing over again.
Oh,
yeah. I don't think that's the case.
The Sonoma County landfill's got a cool operation. You should see that.
The one up Redwood?
Or Sonoma County. Sonoma County.
Okay.
They've got a fleet of buses running off the landfill in addition to 750 kilowatt generators in one building.
Oh, that's great. That is awesome.
So they're going to have neighborhoods and neighborhoods, plus a fleet of buses off the garbage. That's impressive. And they did it with a grant, Department of Transportation grant.
Great. That's great.
Yeah. That's
good model there.
Well, that happened.
Well, they're a landfill. They have more gas generation.
Oh, they have more to work with. Okay. All right.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you, Jason.
Great, thank you. Thanks for all the good feedback. Appreciate that.
Okay, item 10, the proposed revisions to the 2018 Joint Powers Agreement. And this is informational as well.
Yeah, so we've talked about this over the last couple months, through Marksburg's decision to withdraw from the JPA. And also, you know, Sanitary District 2 attorneys have looked at the May adopted 2018 JPA a couple times and had a lot of suggested changes. So the JPA managers have reviewed the SD2 attorneys' comments a couple times and evaluated those. And we've also made some revisions to the May 2018 JPA to reflect Larkspur's withdrawal decision. So just I can just walk you through these really quick. We can just go to the pages actually in the JPA. And I'll just highlight this to you. So on page one, really the main change there is in the opening paragraph. We removed Larkspur and just made a note that the JPA has been amended from time to time. And that was a recommendation by SC2 attorney. On page two, you see there's three new whereas statements and a modification to the above whereas statement above the three new ones. So the primary concern that SD2's attorneys had in their two reviews of the JPA were to be very clear that the 2000 JPA wasn't a new JPA, but it was really an amended and restated JPA through a revision in the editing process. So that led to these two whereas statements. And the managers thought, well, we understood what the process was. It's in our minutes, and there's public documents that talk about it. But it is good to clarify within the JPA. So we accepted those. Then we added the last two whereas statements, which was the decision by the Larkspur City Council, then just stating that this version here is the 8th amendment to the JPA. Then on page 3, you see that the city of Larkspur has been stricken as a definition. In section 2 on page 3, that's some language that was suggested by SD2's attorney, which made sense to us. Then moving on to page 5, section 7, there's two changes. One's in blue, and that's reducing the commission size to 5 commissioners and removing Larkspur as having a member on the board. And then on page 6, under section 8 voting, we changed 4 commissioners constitute a quorum to 3 commissioners, and 3 are required to pass anything versus 4. Just reduce the number. And then, let's see here, the last revision to point out is on page 10 in section 17, indemnification. It's just a little more clear language under section B. That's in red.
In light of the recent spill, I'd like to withdraw that sentence.
And that was recommended by SEU2's attorney also.
In light of the recent spill, that's a good recommendation, I suppose.
If we're going a quorum that goes from 4 to 3, what does that mean about the finance committee existing of 3? Does that mean they all have to be noticed at this time?
Well, that committee is a standing committee.
Okay.
So you could have 3, and it is, as a standing committee, it is a notice meeting. So we do have an agenda, and it's posted on the bulletin board and on the website. But that, you know, that the board can decide if they would have the committee to be remain as 3 or have it as 2. That's up to the board to decide. Yeah, so those are primarily the changes to the JPA. So the managers, we've talked about these and reviewed these over our last couple meetings. The document in front of you has been vetted by all of us, and we think it is it's pretty good. We agree with the changes. They make sense to us. And the managers are going to be presenting this revised JPA to each of their respective boards in over the next few months. And then the one kind of administrative detail we have to work out is the provision. I mentioned this briefly last month in our the 2006 payment agreements between the member agencies and CMSA, which is one of the bond documents, says that the JPA cannot be terminated and the member cannot withdraw unless there's no negative impact to the bondholders. So the rating agencies have to make that determination, or the bond council has to state that in opinion. So I talked with, you know, Sarah Hollenbeck from PFM and Sean from Hawkins Delafield Wood, and explained to them the relationship between Ross Valley and Larkspur after the annexation, and that Larkspur hasn't contributed any funding to CMSA for regional charges, capital fee, or for debt service. So they fully understand that Larkspur withdrawal doesn't impact CMSA operations or the bondholders. So they've today I got information back from Sarah Hollenbeck that she had contacted the rating agency. She's talked to them about this, but she's waiting to hear back from them. It got a little slow at their offices during the holidays, she said. So we're waiting to either get some type of written assurance from them, and if they aren't willing to do that, then Sean Cheery with Hawkins Delafield will issue an opinion. And then once we have that, then the JPA can be amended and Larkspur can withdraw.
But we prefer massively, I prefer the rating agencies give us that directly.
We prefer that also. The question is if they would do that. We're hopeful.
And is there a contemplation of a separate agreement authorizing the withdrawal?
That hasn't been discussed by the managers. I don't think that Larkspur talked about that at their council meetings. Through the JPA.
Is from the JPA?
No. As much as we're going to miss you, we would...
Flowers, chocolates. Chocolate's always good.
I think it's important that we have a separate agreement consistent with Section 20, where we authorize this and where Larkspur makes representations about what it's going to do and what it's bound by. And I'm particularly thinking of, at the moment, we're not aware of any consequence that their withdrawal might have, but something may come up. And we need some sort of commitment from them.
So this is an agreement between Larkspur and the other JPA members.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Consistent with Section 20, saying we hereby authorize, Larkspur says they want to leave, we authorize them to leave under these conditions. And then we all agree. And I guess that's And then we would separately have the revised. Then there'd be like this agreement would be like a companion to that agreement.
Sure.
Where the remaining members would then sign the revised JPA.
Well, I'll communicate that to the JPA managers. But I would say it'd be great if when they bring this up with the individual boards, you guys can talk to them about that also.
Yes, we'll let the boards know. Ask Jack Gobi. We need the lawyers to write this up.
Sure, sure. Do you want CMSA's lawyer to do that? I could ask Jack to prepare a draft agreement.
Mark's first lawyer to do. Mark's first one wants out.
I could talk to Dan about that.
And see yeah, you're the one asking for this particular additional document.
You can share the recorded part so Dan understands what Mary Beth said.
Okay.
Or Sky, or city attorney.
So Mary Beth, are you saying that this document that will be prepared by Larkspur's attorney will then be signed by Larkspur and the JPA members individually?
Right.
And then
agreeing to them.
Yeah. Right. And then so there is nothing then for this board to do, for this commission to do, except the new JPA at a future meeting.
No, this board is not a member of the JPA.
That's true. It sounds an awful lot like alimony.
Like what?
It is. It's like,
I've never been through it, so yeah, educate me.
Right. Yeah, Larkspur is filed for divorce, and we need to have a dissolution document that spells out exactly who's going to get what out of this.
Can I make a suggestion? Because I understand this. I don't have any particular objection.
I don't know what anybody's going to say in response.
This is news to me, so why don't we ask the CMSA's attorney as an advisory, because if this issue was brought up here in the CMSA meeting, if this is necessary, if the JPA covers this all, I don't object to it, Mary Beth. I'm happy also to ask on behalf of, as a representative of the CMSA representing Ross Valley Sanitary, I'd be happy to ask the Ross Valley Sanitary attorney if they think it's necessary, but I'd like us to ask our attorney if it's necessary, because if we don't need an alimony document because we said it's a quick divorce, it's an annulment. It's not it's an annulment.
I don't know what any previous commitments require. Okay.
Right. Well, let's look at the words of Section 20. Say, we'll convene a meeting to discuss the withdrawal process and the details. We need to, that needs to be spelled out, and they need to agree to it. I don't think we want to create the precedent that any member can go to its underlying body, like SRSAN, can't decide we want out, and then that's it. That's not the process. We have to agree.
Oh, yeah. That is what the agreement says, that we have to agree.
Right.
All of us.
And the revised JPA doesn't have all of us agreeing to that. It's implicit because Larkspur's gone, but we're not saying Larkspur's promised to do this, that, and the other thing, and on those terms, we'll let Larkspur go. It just says Larkspur wants out.
Has this conversation already been had at the manager's level?
We've evaluated Larkspur leaving in relation to the conditions of the JPA, and Jack Gobi has. And just from what's in the JPA, we didn't see any issue with Larkspur leaving. But if it was somebody else, there'd be significant issues with it.
Was it included in the discussion that we would have a rider for unforeseen stuff? I mean,
this is a new development, and it would just be comforting maybe to the JPA members knowing that they want to withdraw. If we agree to that, if anything comes up in the future that has some financial implications to CMSA resulting from the withdrawal, then Larkspur needs to reconvene with the members and discuss how we're going to handle that. Is that kind of what we're thinking about?
Yeah.
Just kind of an assurance that
there's
that a reopener if needed.
If needed, but it's very important that we document that all the members have to agree before any member can leave.
I agree with that 100%, but I thought we wrote that into the revised JPA, and by us all agreeing, if we do, to this new amended one, we would be doing such.
Implicitly. It's an implicit acceptance.
Well, why don't we just change the whereas so it's not so implicit and more...
Well, because Larkspur's not standing. We need Larkspur to sign it.
Okay.
That's the point.
Okay.
That's the point. We need Larkspur.
Just so wouldn't Larkspur.
So Dan, having listened.
Okay.
I'll talk with Goyo and give him a summary of what we talked about. Ask him, is it necessary or is it something that's valuable to the agency and the members?
Yeah, I'm not envisioning a lengthy agreement. This is a couple of pages.
Well, can I ask you this question? If the Larkspur City Council met and just prior to or right after, you know, and we had an agreement with them, that they agreed to the withdrawal as per the newer February 2019 amended JPA agreement, that they're agreeing that their withdrawal is on those terms, would that suffice, or is there something?
No. I think this needs to be explicit, that all of the original members, including Larkspur, agree that Larkspur is going to leave. That's what we contemplated in Section 20, so that if any of the rest of us decide we need to leave, we're going to use that same process. Admittedly, in this instance, it's a very short process. It's probably a very short agreement because we can't. At the moment, we don't see any implications of it. But on the off chance that something happens, we need another.
Well, again, I have.
It's just a paper. It just keeps things clean. And we have an old JPA. We have a new agreement amongst all of the original members saying that one of them is out. And then we have the new
JPA.
The new JPA with the surviving members.
Okay.
The clean part is yet to be seen.
Right. That
take a look.
Right. It would be something very simple and very standard. This sort of thing is very common.
So, a little unclear then, is that signed at SRSD's level and
yes.
Ross Valley's level, and then it's then just brought to this, presented by Jason at this meeting, and we accept it?
It's just
informational for.
We're not a member of the JPA. Those four districts are. So as long as those four districts all agree, and that's what you're saying right now.
Right. That was just kind of an FYI to Jason and crew that.
That's all I was trying to clarify. Who's signing what here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I'll let the managers know, and I will talk to Jeff Goldie about the idea, and we will extract out that this discussion from the audio and send it over to Dan Schwartz, and I'll explain to him in an email and on the phone kind of what we're looking at. Okay, great.
Okay, no other comments. Item 11, informational items. Is there anything to point out?
Not from staff.
Thank you. North Bay Watershed Association report.
Normally meets the first Friday of each month, but because it was a new year last Friday, they're meeting this Friday, and if anybody wanted to attend at Marin Municipal Water District at 9:30, there's going to be pretty cool stuff. One being the people from Marin County that are working on sea level rise and what's happening and what are their thoughts and opinions. And so they're usually pretty interesting. And a guy named Steve Moore, who happens to be the new general manager at RBSD, who used to be on the California Water Board, is going to be giving a talk about the status of the Delta project. Because he just left there 6 weeks ago, and will be giving us an update on that. So at the next meeting, I will give you more about that, but if anybody wanted to attend, 9:30 MMWD.
And which date?
Friday.
This spring.
Yeah. Go ride your bike.
Yeah?
Walk over. It should be pretty good.
No, I want to see it.
It's a good meeting.
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Okay, oral reports by commissioners or GM.
Okay, just a few things that I mentioned on the handout here. When I did meet with Diane first, and I gave her the resolution of appreciation that was adopted by the board, and took her to lunch, and we had a great time, and she thought the resolution looked wonderful, and she expressed her thanks to everybody for that. Then the next is that we're all really happy about this, is that the agency didn't have any permit exceedances in calendar 2018. So that's great news. So we'll be hopefully receiving a gold peak performance award from the National Association later this summer. And then lastly, we had that big, you know, rain event on Sunday, and this is a process control system printout of the flows at the agency, the black line, then Ross Valley, the green line, then San Rafael, the blue line, then SD2, then San Quentin State Prison. So you see our flows increased at CMSA here from about 8 or 9 MGD up to 102 MGD, so pretty significant increase of flows. And we measured about 3.68 inches of rain at our headworks during that 24-hour period. And we were blending for about a day and a half.
I appreciate that being on the web so fast because your blending history is already on the web.
Yeah.
I noted it was on the web Monday morning when we met, you and me and Michael met. It was on the website that had been blending since yesterday.
That's right.
It has an undetermined amount of time. And I noticed earlier today that it had been ceased as a blending, so that was a short period.
Yeah.
So that was good. And I appreciate that it's available to the public.
That's a requirement in our NPS permit that we have that information on the website.
I guess I then change that to I'm pleased that it's accurate.
Okay, that's all I have.
I have a question.
Yeah.
This chart shows that the significant impact that was the inundation and
inflow.
What would it take to come up with some sort of a cost? What does it cost the agency to do this? What does a typical storm or
to reduce INI?
No, not to reduce INI, to treat rainwater.
What does it cost to treat it?
Yeah, well, basically, what does this spike cost us? What is the difference between dry weather and wet weather, which is INI? What does that cost us?
Well, you know, there's a couple ways to look at it. One is you see the 90 MGD line right there?
Mm-hmm.
So a little spike between 90 up to 100.
Mm-hmm.
The capacity to receive and process and dispose of that costs us $40 million. That was the wet weather improvement program that gave us that little additional capacity right there. Operational costs, it's not more significant because we don't do a lot of internal pumping. Everything just flows here, and then we use gravity to move the water through the plant. So there's additional, additional energy because we have all the tanks on. There's some additional, disinfection and dechlorinating chemicals for each event. And if the event's significant, when there's a high tide, then there's some diesel fuel cost to pump, to use the effluent pumpers to pump it out. So for us, with all the existing infrastructure, again, not the internal pumping, the operational costs aren't significant to handle this because we have the infrastructure to receive it and process it. There's additional, staffing costs too, because during these events, we have laboratory people that are on standby, so they pay me on standby, then they come in on call pay. And we might have maintenance people have to come in to address, mechanical problems during these large events. And we also have additional operators on wet weather standby that come in just to have sort of the helping hand here when all the alarms are going off.
Mm-hmm.
And things have to be addressed during, these type of events.
Mm-hmm.
Each event's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But, we're just fortunate that we have all the infrastructure and systems in place to receive and treat the water.
Right, but those didn't fall from the sky. Those are capital costs
that
have been incurred, significant, and ongoing.
$40 million over, say, a 40-year life, 50-year life?
Yeah, probably 50 years.
Yeah. So that's
plus all the, O&M associated with that.
So it's maybe $1 million a year you're amortizing.
Yeah, we look at it.
Yeah.
But each of our
plus
the operating cost.
Yeah. Each of our agencies has made a commitment through the NPDES permit to work to reduce INI over the next number of years.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Nothing else. Then the next meeting is February 12th. All right. This meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you. Good job.